Right now, it is time to bring in our good friend David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Well, hello. I'm happy to be reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City. Glad to be joining the constantly diligent seeker after truth, Marshall Miles. Good to be with you, Marshall.
You know, something we haven't talked about, and I guess I want to bring it up because I was tooling around the BBC website and some other websites, and I saw a story that absolutely amazed me. And I've been listening to the news, and I've heard about the crisis and with Evergrande and China, but the thing that really amazed me, and I don't think most people realize this, is that the story that I read showed that China has these cities, and I'm talking about complete cities. And Evergrande has built so many of these cities, they could actually house the population of Germany, and those cities, for all intents and purposes, are virtually empty. This is how big of a story this Evergrande story is. It's not only going to affect China and what goes on in China, but do you think it's big enough where it's really going to totally affect what happens in the world financing?
Well, I think it's almost inevitable that anything that happens in China is going to be on a vast scale, and that vast scale is almost bound to affect us. I'm glad you're tooling around and finding stories in the BBC. I want a fanfare this week, a particular piece of BBC journalism, but we'll get to that in a moment. But the fact that the BBC has got the capacity, as it does, is a huge news organization, without parallel in the world. Its funding basis is unlike anybody else's, and they spend a lot of time investing in overseas work, because of course they are quite literally a world service, and their investigation and their coverage of the Chinese economy is an example to us all. You'll see it in print too. I mean, The Economist, also emanating from London, does very good coverage of the Chinese economy too. But of course, what's helpful every now and again to in checking into sources like that is to remind ourselves of the sheer scale of almost any story coming out of China. I mean, the size of its population and its extraordinary speed because of its, I guess, it's entirely because of the centralized nature of its economy. I mean, if ever there was a classic case of Marxist principles at work, it has been the Chinese Communist Party's grip on the country. It's the technical phrase is a centrally directed economy, and it certainly is centrally directed. I mean, an edict goes out from the Communist Party. Essentially, it is the Communist Party, not the government, although it's hard to distinguish those two entities anyway in China. The edict goes out from the party / government from Beijing, and it is enacted in every detail throughout the country. And so, while they have embraced an entry into the capitalist system of the world as a whole, to great effect over the last 20, 30 years, what you'll see in China is everything magnified by the sheer economic capacity that the country possesses, and involved in that, one element of that which is so striking is the speed at which it's happened. I mean, it was once upon a time an agrarian economy, and now, of course, massively industrialized, and more to the point, I guess, as we come towards the present day in its progress, industrialized in the high-tech area too. And particularly in the areas of artificial intelligence and those other elements of the electronic revolution that they've leapfrogged forward, arguably, and of course the West does argue this, that it's on the basis of taking technology from the West without paying for it in many cases, and assimilating it into its system with such extraordinary capacity and huge results. And as you say, those huge results include these property developments, which are ginormous. And of course, they've overreached. And one of the things about growth is that sometimes it does overreach. We've seen this in the West time and time again. This example in China is, of course, bigger than anything. And has happened more quickly than any of the experts at work on it could have anticipated, and inevitably Western markets are getting the jitters from it. We've seen this again and again in the past few months, and if it continues to balloon, then inevitably it's going to have its impact upon the Western economies too.
It's hard for people, I think, to realize how globally connected, and you know what? All governments wanted this, how globally connected we are financially with one another, whether you're communist China, whether you're the United States, whether you're Germany, whether you're Argentina, they're all tied together.
Yeah, the world financial system was very eager to embrace China. Of course, it's a huge market. I mean, it goes two ways. Of course, I mean, they can start to dominate the world, but the West, if I can put it in these personal terms, personal plural terms, we get the opportunity to sell to enormous numbers of the Chinese population who now have buying power beyond any. Everybody's imagining 30 years ago in China, and the effort to get China into the World Trade Organization, they're now a member, a rather unruly member, it has to be said, but they are in, to a large degree, integrated with us, and inevitably there will be consequences.
All right, well, I think it is time for us to bring in the fanfare for the BBC and your segment this morning. Ah, there it is.
Good to hear the fanfare after we had trouble with it last week. It's indeed, the fanfare this week is for a part of the BBC World Service. It's a remarkable piece of work that I want to draw attention to. It's a solid piece of historical documentary making on radio. It's a series from the World Service, as I say, and it's called, very straightforwardly, and this is one of the things about it that I like, it's just called The Story of AIDS. And the title is typical of the show as a whole. It's solid, simple, straightforward. The show itself is not overheated, never hysterical, though there's inevitably a lot of strong feeling expressed throughout it. It's in 3-hour-long episodes, and it traces the disease from first being noticed in the early 1980s right through to the present day. It's although it's about history, it's powerfully timely, not just because AIDS, of course, is still a terrible scourge across much of the world, but also... because of the very clear parallels to be drawn between that history and our much newer world health crisis of COVID-19. There's so many parallels that we can draw. The previously totally unknown and initially baffling and unstoppable disease, spreading and panicking people, the upsurge of anger among people based on misinformation and intolerance of others, the appalling effects at the time of people's ignorance and fierce irrational denialism too, denial that it was happening at all, and also the you know, on the positive side, the determined and surprisingly fast development of the scientific response. I mean, for AIDS, that was antiretroviral drugs, of course, and in COVID's case, the various vaccines we now have. It's great. It's a great piece of broadcast journalism. One of my main points about it. I mentioned the cool title. The whole thing is delivered in a cool broadcasting manner. It was, if it was like so many of the popular podcasts that are streaming across the cyberspace now, it would have had a much catchier title, I'm sure. It would have been a loud declamatory title, no doubt, and I'm almost sure it would have been plastered from beginning to end with emotion-heightening music. I mean, you know the kind of thing that we hear on podcasts these days. Mercifully, in this wonderfully professional piece, there's very little music. It's used only strategically to mark a change of direction or a shift in emphasis. It's never trying to do what music scores do far too often for me in all forms of broadcasting. It's trying to tell us what we're supposed to be feeling at any particular moment. So I tip my hat to this team. It's presenter Audrey Brown, producer Richard Fenton-Smith, and sound engineer Tom Brignall. It's a great piece of work, well worth our fanfare.
Music should be used in movies and only for dramatic effect. I'm sorry.
I remember experiencing a lot of pressure when I was making a documentary for ABC News. Excuse me. And it was about a racial massacre. I made it in the late 90s, mid-90s to be precise, more precise. The editing team really wanted to bring in really powerful, suggestive music at various points in this documentary when I got to the editing stage of it. And thank goodness, I was actually working for ABC News. And in those days, at least, ABC News held firmly to what were called ABC News standards. In fact, all the major networks had these standards, and one of them was you don't have any music in your documentary unless the music was happening on location when you shot the material. So that was a hard and fast rule, and it helped me. I mean, on occasions you can see documentary makers trying to hold to those rules and cheating somewhat. Suddenly seeing that someone in a car turns on the car radio for no evident reason, but the reason is to be able to get music into the into the soundtrack of the documentary, and then of course they can take lots of liberties with that music and make it do all sorts of things that it wasn't really doing at the time, but it serves the suggestive power that documentary makers often want to use music for.
I'm going to turn 180 degrees here. I've made fun of William Shatner before he went up in this flight, the Blue Origin. We interviewed Bill Shatner here, and it was nice to do an interview, but he's a little pompous and he's a little self-centered, and you can tell that from from his cast.
Well, give him a break. He's 90 years old with a big fat career behind him.
and it's verified by the people that work with him. But one thing I noticed, when he came back from his little excursion into space and back down, unlike everybody else who talked about being weightless and floating around and everything like this, he went on for about 15 minutes talking about how striking it was to see that little thin blue line of atmosphere and basically how small and tiny we are. He's the only one that recently, with all these private flights into space, that has talked about really something totally different than, hey, I went to space and had a good time. So I want to credit Bill Shatner for that, because he really was struck by that little flight he took into space.
Yeah, in some ways, popular figures like Shatner but do actually have a public role. There's an old phrase, you know, when the Tribune of the People. someone who is there in a function that is to represent the ordinary person, the regular person. And, you know, and you know, the fact is that this is a highly selective group on the whole. It's people with a lot of money, mostly. But in this particular case, the Amazon boss, Jeff Bezos, has done a kind of off-the-books deal, if I can use that phrase, with people. We don't know how much money changes hands in these particular seats on the Blue Horizon rocket, if that's too simple a label for it. what we have amongst this group is this one individual who has not paid his way, one presumes, and is doing it because of his public status. And what's interesting is that he went back in time almost to the kind of awe, sense of awe that we had from the original astronauts back in the 60s and 70s. The way that he was choosing to phrase it was powerful, and you know, as you say, compared with the others who spoke about their own personal sensations, he was talking about a change of perspective, quite literally. I mean, getting a view, and this is what he wanted. He said this before the flight, and he confirmed it again after the flight, that he wanted to have a sense from a totally different angle of what it is that we're looking at when we can look at our Earth. And of course, you know, as we're standing on the Earth, we can take in this perspective too, but to have it jiltingly brought to bear on you by being up there above it, or outside of it at least, the idea of direction is almost irrelevant when you get to on this scale. You're not of this Earth for a few minutes at least, and you're able to get that change of angle, change of perspective, change of view. It's a reminder. It's an ecological thought, of course, and that's the point of it all for Shatner, it seems, or at least that's the way he was phrasing it. That this is a reminder that our Earth is a precious, precious commodity, and we all need to take a different look at it completely.
Yep, I was very surprised and happy the way he did that. Now another story that I got from the BBC, and this is. Things like this is what makes the COVID pandemic and all the false and accurate and accusations. A COVID lab in Wolverhampton has been suspended. Why? About 43,000 people in England and Wales were probably wrongly told that the COVID-19 test was negative because of errors at a private factory laboratory.
Sure. These things happen. And we must not be surprised. We must safeguard against them, of course, and keep popular pressure on the pharmaceutical industry that lies behind not just the manufacture of drugs, but these testing processes too. It happens, and there will be false steps like this in the handling of such a massive pandemic disease as this. We haven't had anything of that scale, I don't think, in the United States, but testing errors are woven into the fabric of our scientific response to this pandemic.
Another story that really shakes the ground that I stand on. Now, I'm not even a liberal. I'm a progressive. I'm beyond being a liberal, all right? And there's a lot of things I agree with. I don't agree with defunding the police. I don't agree with the way activists are going about trying to change the way police are regulated. I think you can change the way police are regulated by changing laws where local government can demand more responsibility to root rogue people out. They're voting to defund the police. And you know what? There's actually a chance in Minneapolis that this thing might pass. When what they really want to do is put more community action people, more mental health people into the police department. But by voting on a thing to defund the police, it sets a very dangerous precedent.
Well, you'll have the test case unfolding in front of you with the Minneapolis vote. It's perhaps not surprising while the argument does swirl around the country as a whole in the wake of the George Floyd killing, it's in the city where that killing actually happened, where it has come to a crunch most immediately. The vote's taking place this week, and the campaigning is loud and vociferous, of course, as it would be. The language is interesting to note. The words defund and abolish are, of course, they've taken on a somewhat tremulously, almost toxic strength and intensity now, and a lot of campaigners are turning away from those words sensibly, I think, because in the end, whatever gets created, if police departments are in some way changed, they will still need funding, and they will still need funding by very large amounts of local taxpayer money. The idea of police reform, I think, has also become somewhat tarnished over this period of controversy. Is it enough to just reform the police? We've seen reforms take place. We've seen federal supervision of local police forces take place. And in the end, very little has changed over time. And so you can understand why there should be calls for something a lot more radical. Now, whether that means that you buttress armed police with a lot more social workers and other kind of people who can intervene in situations in which deadly force is not needed, it's unknown what the outcome of that drift shift can be. There's only one way to find out, unfortunately, and that's to try it in some way. And the argument about how far you go in making the change is going to be tested out most clearly, I think, and most immediately in Minneapolis than anywhere else.
We'll change things over now and go back to January 6th. The January 6th committee right now is working and sending out notifications to people that they want to come and testify. And Steve Bannon is... right off the top of the bat, the first one that is not going to testify, and so the commission is going.
We should not be surprised that Steve Bannon should be uncooperative with an investigation into something that he's clearly been involved with, the January 6th storming of the Capitol building. But what's so interesting is that the House Investigatory Committee, the subcommittee of the House, the joint subcommittee of the House investigating the 6th of January events is now very seriously threatening him with criminal contempt charges. The other members of Trump's coterie, if you like, who have been subpoenaed, or they're attempting to subpoena anyway, people who actually held office at the time in the Trump administration, one in particular, the chief of staff, Mark Meadows. But in Bannon's case, he wasn't even a member of the administration. He'd been let go a lot earlier, like an awful lot of Trump of people who are close to Trump. He was frozen out and sent packing. So at the time, he was not so frozen out anymore. He was in contact with Trump, and although not a member of the administration, was clearly performing some kind of role. What exactly, we don't know, and that's what the committee wants to find out. But what is clear and what's on the public record is that immediately before the events of January the 6th, Steve Bannon was predicting what he called, carefully quote him exactly, a cataclysmic battle. So he was certainly in the business of stirring up great inflammatory rhetoric around that event, and of course that event became indeed very inflammatory. Now he's able to he thinks he's able to argue that he is protected by executive privilege because he was doing everything on the he's certainly taking orders now in refusing to talk to the committee, appear before the committee, on the grounds of being what I'm trying to say is that Trump has told him not to talk now, and because of executive privilege, and it seems that he was acting in concert with Donald J. Trump at the time. The logic of his position is that I'm protected by executive privilege, and therefore we must draw the conclusion that he presumes himself to be part of an executive plan. Now, if that's true, then this is extremely serious. If it's not true, then it's probably just another of Donald Trump's classic delaying tactics when it comes to any brush with the law. As we know, he's always been an incredibly contentious litigator, and litigiousness is his middle name in many ways, and he can draw things out whenever there's a legal threat to him. He could draw things out over time almost interminably, and in this case, Bannon is working at the feet of the master and imitating those old tactics, and we will see. The threat of a criminal charge might make a difference. With the others, it seems to be rather different. They're at least still talking through their lawyers, of course, with the committee. So it's possible, I suppose, that we might see them agreeing to come along and give a deposition and even appear before the committee in hearing, perhaps in camera, perhaps in public. We'll have to see.
I want to hop out to Lebanon, what happened in Beirut this week. And it really dates back to the port blast in 2020. People were protesting the removal of a judge who was in charge of that investigation. And once again, violence broke out in that city that has just had such a great historic and beautiful past, and it just seems Beirut just can't get back to that place it once was.
Sure. It's another case, I think, and we're talking in general terms about COVID repeating some of the lessons learned or not learned from the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. But there's another matter where history seems to be repeating itself, certainly for many of us reporters, when we look at the bloody shooting violence in Beirut. It's evoking comparisons with that terrible civil war of the 70s, which I and many other people reported on. But it's the militant Shiite organizations, Hezbollah and Amal. They've been protesting against Tarek Bitar, who is the investigating judge you mentioned, who's conducting inquiries into the massive explosion in the city last year, the great warehousing of explosive material that did so much damage to the city then and killed hundreds of people. The Shiites have been claiming that the judge is targeting their political leaders in particular with political motives in doing his probing. And they also, as they came out in the streets organizing this demonstration, they also blamed the Lebanese army snipers for opening fire first on them. And of course, the army is claiming the opposite. This feels all too familiar to me, I suspect that those militants who came out with their guns, maybe not at the immediate ready as they were demonstrating in the street, but there are reports of people running off from the street demonstration into the side streets and coming back with arms and taking up positions and firing. So inevitably there have been deaths again, and chaos is cranked up a notch even more, and Beirut's starting to look again like the mess that it has been so many times in its recent history, which, as you say, is a sad reflection on on the city, because you know, those of us who know it know that it has a proud and wonderful history as a crystallizing of culture and sophistication as a city, often called the Paris of the Middle East.
David, always great to talk with you on a weekly basis on Friday. We'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio.